Now, having stated this contrast, this thesis and antithesis now presented, both are in antithetical relationship, one side and the other. Now the argument, to the ordinary material intellect, which takes its present organization of consciousness for the limit of its possibilities, the direct contradiction of the unrealized ideals with the realized fact is a final argument against their validity. That is to say, these ideals are bound to be denied, to be valid. Why? Because we take our normal stance on our material organization of consciousness. And we think it is final. We take our present mentality to be the final mentality, as if it is the final. And we argue that because the actual is in direct contradiction with the ideal, therefore ideal is false. This is real. What I see is real. That is a dream and never to be realized. Because how can it be? This is all that is going to be, and this is the permanent thing here. The material intellect takes its present organization of consciousness as a final limit, rightly or wrongly, but materialistic intellect which is in us, we are all materialists basically, because whether we like it or not, our intellect is material, is bound by the material physical body. That material intellect, whenever it sees an ideal, it is bound to dismiss it as saying, oh my Lord, it's a dream, it can never be true, invalid. And it is a final argument. Even the great spiritual people, when they are on the verge of physical mortality, they find physical mortality to be the real fact, and all the search for immortality, amritattvam, it seems to be a dream. In imagination one has gone into it, because the real fact is only this. So, to the material intellect, that which is actual and now seems to be the ultimate. Nothing more than this. And that death is a real fact. Immortality is an imagination dream. Therefore, that dream is invalid. For philosophically, therefore, this is the argument. That this thesis and antithesis ends in a conclusion that what is actual is real, what is ideal is unreal, and therefore it cannot be valid. This is the conclusion. It's a part of dialectical reasoning. Now this dialectical reasoning, Sri Aurobindo goes farther. And he says that this conclusion can be further invalidated. But if we take a more deliberate view of the world's workings, that direct opposition appears rather as a part of nature's profoundest method and the seal of her completest sanction. Now this statement is a very important statement. It's a turn in the argument, philosophical argument. If we take, he doesn't say we must take, philosophy is not an inevitable preoccupation of man, You may become philosopher, you may not. But if you want to be a philosopher, if you want a philosophical argument, then this is the philosophical argument. If we take a more deliberate view, what's the meaning of a deliberate view? A deliberate view of nature is that nature is not arbitrary. Nothing is arbitrary. There's a meaning in it. Everything has a meaning in the world. There's a rationality. Rationality is reasonableness, to see reasonableness everywhere. There is no cloud and yet it is raining. It's not possible. If it rains without a cloud, it's not reasonable. There must be a cloud before a rain takes place. It's not arbitrary. If some child says, why is it raining? I say, because there's a cloud, my child. I say, it's not arbitrarily happening. I take a deliberate view. Nothing in the world happens just arbitrarily. So if there is a contrast between this actual fact and that ideal, and if you take a deliberate view of it, why is it? Why is there this contrast at all? This is the question. Why is there a contrast? Then you are led to inquire into the method of nature's working. This is a new argument in a philosophical world. In the philosophical thought, it's a new argument. If you take a more deliberate view of the nature's methods of working, nature's method is philosophical, is rational movements. There's a method in it. Even if the madness is a method in the madness, this method of nature is a very interesting method. Its very method is the method of contrast. The very method of nature's working is to state which only conceals very resolutely something that is very difficult to reveal. But it is precisely that which is going to be revealed. That's the method of nature. If you examine the whole history of mankind, the complete, not only of mankind, but the whole history of evolution, this is the method. If you examine the very method of nature's working, jahan inkar hai, wahin ikrar hai. Where there is a complete negation, there is a real agreement. The nature starts with a negation. The very method of nature is negation. As it moves on and on, you knock and knock and knock. The exact opposite will be revealed itself out. This argument is what I call the quintessential metaphysical argument. If there is one metaphysical argument, it is to look into the deliberate. Metaphysical argument is an argument to look deliberately into the deliberate methods of nature. And then if you knock with that argument, then you'll find that that ideal, which is now denied by the actuality, is the only thing that is going to be established. That is through metaphysical reasoning, which wants to look into the very nature, movements of nature. The one inevitable thing is that that which is being denied is the very thing which is going to be affirmed. In the next paragraph, Sri Aurobindo enunciates this method of nature. He establishes his method of nature. If you are tired, we shall stop here. If you are not tired, I'll finish this third paragraph. Depends upon the fatigue.
It's okay.
Huh?
We can continue.
Okay? What is that method of nature? Now Sri Aurobindo describes the very method of nature. And he starts by saying, all problems of existence are essentially problems of harmony. This is the nature of all the problems, not only this contrast between actualized fact and all that, but all problems. You know, when I see an object, I see a garland here. My very perceptual apparatus is atomic. The rays of light which are coming from there, which are being grasped by my eyes, are all atomic. But my perception is harmonic. It's a very surprising fact. This is what modern psychology, called gestalt psychology, has brought out very clearly. It's a German psychological school which says that all human apparatus tends toward gestalt. Even in the perceptual consciousness, because of gestalt, I don't see atomic perceptions. I see convergence. Even when the things are disparate, I see convergence. In fact, the greatest artists are those who leave the two ends open, leaving the rear to converge. This is called the great art of expression. The greatest artists don't tell you the conclusion. They leave the propositions, but in such a manner that the viewer is obliged to converge and to derive the meaning out of it. So, whether it is in the field of mere perception or in the very movement of artistic perception, in every moment of life, particularly whenever I see a problem, and the contrast is always a problem. One is opposed to the other is a problem. Sri Aurobindo says, be sure, this is the argument. Whenever there is a problem, there is a law which you should see in nature. No problem is created unless there is a secret harmony somewhere. Somewhere there is a concealed harmony, and there is a constant emergent drive towards that harmony. All problems of existence are essentially problems of harmony. Now I'll read out the whole paragraph at one stroke. They arise from the perception of an unsolved discord and the instinct of an undiscovered agreement or unity. To rest content with an unsolved discord is possible for the practical and more animal part of man, but impossible for his fully awakened mind. And usually, even his practical parts only escape from the general necessity either by shutting out the problem or by accepting a rough, utilitarian and unillumined compromise. For essentially, all nature seeks a harmony. Life and matter in their own sphere, as much as mind in the arrangement of its perceptions. The greater the apparent disorder of the materials offered, or the apparent disparateness, even to irreconcilable opposition of the elements that are to be utilized, the stronger is the spurs and drives towards a more subtle and puissant order than can normally be the result of a less difficult endeavor. The accordance of active life with a material of form, in which the condition of activity itself seems to be inertia, is one problem of opposites that nature has solved and seeks always to solve better with greater complexities. For its perfect solution would be the material immortality of a fully organized, mind-supporting animal body. The accordance of conscious mind and conscious will with a form and a life in themselves not overtly self-conscious and capable at best of a mechanical or subconscious will is another problem of opposites in which she has produced astonishing results and aims always at higher marvels. For there, her ultimate miracle would be an animal consciousness, no longer seeking, but possessed of truth and light, with the practical omnipotence which would result from the possession of a direct and perfected knowledge. Not only then is the upward impulse of man towards the accordance of yet higher opposites rational in itself, but it is the only logical completion of a rule and an effort that seemed to be a fundamental method of nature and the very sense of our universal strivings. I shall not read further. We shall leave it for tomorrow. It's a very important paragraph, very important argument. And the rest of the whole book rests upon this argument. So we shall leave it here. If you have time, you think about it. If you don't have time, don't worry about it. We shall do it tomorrow. So we shall stop it today, 2 o'clock exactly.